Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Even in the dog days of August, the orthodox two guests and two segments format prevails. Osita Wanevu will diagnose the flaws in our flawed democracy, and in yet another break from all the dispiriting news of genocidal war and incipient fascism, Derek Guy will analyze the political economy of upper-class men's dress over the decades. Extending a popular theme in Behind the News, my first guest has plenty of thoughts about what's undemocratic about the American political system and some ideas of how to remedy it. He's Osita Wanevu, author of The Right of the People, Democracy and the Case for a New American Founding, just out from Random House. He's also a contributing editor at The New Republic, a columnist for The Guardian, and a fellow at the Roosevelt Institute. Democracy in itself doesn't always move me, but he has an expansive view of the idea, including its economic dimensions, which we don't talk about enough, so you'll have to read the book for more. Osita Wanevu, what is democracy?
So democracy is a system in which the governed govern. That's the most succinct definition that I think I've been able to come up with. It's a system where the governed themselves, not some king, not some higher authority given arbitrary power, but the governed themselves direct society, direct their lives, direct their institutions. Another good gloss on this is Lincoln's of the people, by the people, for the people rendering of government. That's the basic idea. I think that we've gotten ourselves to a point where most people, when you say democracy, think about the electoral process we have now. You know, every couple of years, you go to the polls, you cast a vote that lands in a, I guess now a digital ballot. You elect some guy, and that's kind of the whole thing. But obviously, you know, there have been many different kinds of instantiations of the concept of rule by the people. Famously, in the Western tradition, we tell ourselves that this began in Athens, where people had direct power to go in the assembly and make the laws, laws that would be implemented, you know, by people chosen through sortition randomly. So across that spectrum from Athenian government to modern day representative government, which are very, very different, I think the common idea across democratic systems is the people themselves are the ones who are actually there governing their institutions.
Is this a means or an end? Is it a strategy for better governance, or is democracy a virtue in itself?
I have come to the position that democracy is a virtue in itself. I think that there are practical reasons why democracy is preferable to other systems of rule. I think that there are just basic practical, technical reasons why democracy is better than those systems. But I also think that we come to democracy with a kind of basic intuition about how life ought to be structured. That we come to democracy with the intuition that we're all entitled to some measure of control over the conditions that shape our lives. It's not that we are supposed to be victims of circumstance or just kind of helplessly being cast about by the things that happen to us. We're not supposed to be enthralled to people who happen to be more wealthy and more powerful than us. We each have some right to say something, to do things in order to direct the society we live in and direct our own personal lives. I think that's the basic idea. And that is a kind of first principles understanding of how human life ought to be. There is a kind of almost spiritual inclination or sort of understanding of what it does for us as people.
In our democracy, if you want to call it that, the process just comes down to elections and little else. The people enter the polling booth or do a mail-in ballot as long as Donald Trump will allow that. But then they forget about it. They go away. Is that really what a democracy is?
It would be democratic to have a system in which, like in Athens, you know, everybody, if this were possible, would go to some very, very large room and sort of hash things about, among themselves about how to govern. If such a thing were possible, I think that would be consonant with the idea of the governed governing. Obviously, that is not practically possible. Even in Athens, actually, the people who could literally fit within the assembly were not the entire citizenry.
And there were a lot of exclusions to their notion.
And there were a lot
citizens.
Of exclusions, exactly. So in some way, I think that we are also inclined to take seriously representation. I think there are things that representation does that other forms of democratic governance do not do. And I ultimately think there are different values that can shape what a democracy looks like. So there's the direct participation angle. There's representation. To what extent are you choosing some other person to act in your stead? And there's deliberation. So what kind of venues and spaces are there for arguments, discussion of what ought to be done? Ideally, all of these things kind of intersect and interact, and we're balancing them out. There's no easier way to participate in the democratic process than to cast a vote. in forms and spaces where we tell ourselves we're being democratic, it's often the case that the people who have the time to go to a meeting, you know, at 5 p.m., people who are not going to work that evening, who don't have children, who are physically able to do it. There are all kinds of ways in which we actually depend upon the practice of representation. But I also think that elections, and elections here as we know them today, are obviously deeply, deeply flawed and messed up in all kinds of ways. But elections, these kinds of moments in time where we all say to each other, let's have a contest, let's put out our best ideas, let's try to win debates and win positions of authority against people who are otherwise in a position of society, I think that's actually a very, very important thing to have happen. It helps us understand what the issues even are. It tests us. It encourages us to develop the most, the broadest possible arguments for the most large section of the American public or any public that we can. It's a long way of answering the question, but I think ultimately representation is also a form of democracy. It's just important, I think, to ensure that we are not exclusively represented by a class, as happens to be the case now, people who are very, very wealthy, very, very detached, very, very different from ordinary people. And we ought to be looking for more ways to include ordinary folks within the spaces that we consider representative today, more so than they presently are.
Lately, we've been seeing Charlie Kirk. I can't believe we take Charlie Kirk seriously, but I guess that's the world we live in. But we see him and other conservatives picking up Robert Welch of the John Birch Society. This is a republic, not a democracy, and let's keep it that way. Now, there's some historical basis to this, as any reader of the Federalist Papers knows. But why that distinction? Why is it important to conservatives?
Conservatives don't believe in democracy, right? So this thing that I said at the outset, that democracy proceeds from an understanding that we should not just be subject to the hierarchies that we are born into, that we have some right to power as ordinary common people. That, to me, in my understanding of conservatism, people contest this, is an antithetical to their entire project. I think conservatives really, really do believe in the wisdom or the justness of existing hierarchies, existing traditions, existing orders in society, and they fundamentally distrust any efforts to upend those hierarchies on the basis of abstract principles like individual freedom. And, you know, you can read this from Burke, I think, honestly, through Donald Trump, and there are all kinds of evolutions and differences within the movement, but I think that's a fundamental bright line division between conservatives and the rest of us who believe in democracy. And so their effort to defend the system by saying we're a republic and not a democracy stems, I think, from that impulse and that attitude. I think that they see Republican governance, by contrast, as something that is intrinsically opposed to or intrinsically limiting of the power of ordinary people to reshape their situations and reshape society. But what I say in this book is that doesn't actually have to be the case. So Republicanism, by my understanding, you can read people like Philip Pettit on this, you can read people like John McCormick on this, there's a whole tradition of Republican political theorists. Republicanism is basically a system in which power is distributed in some fashion. There's no one guy, one king, who has the power to lord it over anybody else on an arbitrary basis. There's no one class in society that has the power to dominate everybody else on an arbitrary kind of basis or on the basis of their own power. But there are rules. There's, you know, maybe the rule of law, maybe a written constitution, certain rights and privileges, durable institutions for making decisions. But there are anti-democratic versions of that, aristocratic versions of that, and democratic versions of that. What I'm arguing for in the book is creating a democratic republic here in the United States. But when conservatives say this, I think that the natural response for liberals is often to say, all that the founders meant, or all the people in their Republican tradition meant, was a system of representative government. And they actually wanted, in some fashion, a kind of majoritarian democracy. And all they meant by republic is that we're not Athens. I don't think that's historically accurate myself. I think that if you look at the prevailing examples of republicanism that would have been available to the founders that they were drawing from, you look at things like the Roman Republic, for instance, which had certain popular elements, but was absolutely not a representative democracy. You can look at the Italian maritime republics of the Middle Ages and Renaissance, where you had voting amongst a particular class of merchant elites. The founders believed in republicanism. They believed in distributed power. They believed in some role for the public, but they also deeply, deeply feared the public imposing itself on the wealthier elements of American society, and they say this repeatedly. One of the balancing powers that they thought they had to work against was a democratic public. Whereas with a democratic republicanism, the kind that I'm advocating for, it's the public that should take primacy. And in fact, to instantiate and fully empower the public, we actually have to take seriously concentrations of wealth, concentrations of power, more so than the founders did, as themselves wealthy and powerful people. Conservatives had the right side of the argument as a historical matter. But they're confusing is and ought. The fact that the United States is a particular way, it was founded a particular way, obviously is not a justification for not changing anything. It doesn't tell us what kind of society we should be. It's just a description of the status quo. And the status quo, from my perspective, is never an argument for itself.
The $64 trillion question here, though, is democracy, as you talk about it, possible in so unequal a society?
I think that democracy is fundamentally threatened by inequality in a way that I think we don't often take seriously. It was striking to me doing the research for this book that you could read a very, very good book, a lot of very good books on the inequities of our political system, the Senate and the Electoral College, and all these things that I end up talking about myself. But the only place where the economy comes into the picture is when people talk about, you know, we need to get rid of Citizens United, we need to reform campaign finance. It's as though, apart from those things, the economy exists in this kind of wholly separate sphere. And you can actually act within politics, independent from the economy, and use that to regulate the economy without making fundamental changes to the way the economy works. I don't think that's actually true. In fact, I think that one of the reasons why the political reforms and reforms to money in politics we want haven't really gotten anywhere is because we have an economy where certain wealthy people are empowered to such an extent and have the resources to influence the political system to their ends in ways far beyond campaign finance. The way we get news is shaped by economic inequality. The politicians that we have, even if no money is exchanged, even if they're not getting donations, you know, many of those people are millionaires. Many people go to the same schools and talk with the, and interact with the same people who are dominating the economy, and they shape their ideas that way. People set up think tanks. You know, without money changing hands to politicians, they'll put out reports that politicians read from the perspective of a particular industry. All of these things, I think, really, really matter. The crudest and almost caricature-like example of this is the wealthiest man on the planet, because he donated $260 million to Donald Trump's campaign last year, got rewarded with a position in government where he got to rework the executive branch. Then I think parachuted into a Wisconsin judicial election, offered people, you know, $1 million if they voted his way. Like, you could not construct a more left-wing kind of caricature of the reasons why inequality matters. I think the ancients took this seriously, more seriously than we do. So we have a real problem here, an economy that is increasingly dominated by smaller and smaller number of people, people who can use their wealth, use their power against our political institutions, to attack our political institutions. So many companies gave to Republicans who backed Donald Trump's lies, even after January 6th. There's a democratic threat there. But I also think, going back to the original principles I was talking about, why we care about democracy, it's important to consider all the spaces in which we are governed. I think we are not just governed by Washington, by our city hall, by our state houses. I think we're also governed at work. The decisions that are made at the top of corporations we work for often affect us more directly, intimately, and immediately than decisions made by politicians. And yet we don't really have any real say in that decision making. In fact, we have less power than ever, given the erosion of the labor movement of the last few decades. I think that also is a democratic question that matters for people who want to expand and fulfill the promise of democracy.
I'm speaking with Osita Wanevu, author of The Right of the People, just out from Random House. Okay, let's talk some specific reforms here. Now, we're all used to the critiques of the Senate as anti-democratic. You know, California has 67 times the population of Wyoming, but both states have two senators. But there are some serious problems with the House as well, and I hadn't really thought about them until I read your passages on that. So what are the problems with the House, and how could they be fixed?
Well, I think we're all in the middle of this big debate about gerrymandering at this moment. That's another pretty bright line problem for people who care about democracy. You should not be able to draw yourself, your own electorate, as a politician. You should not be able to draw your opponents out of power because you control the process of drawing districts. But we've accepted this in politics for quite a long time, and it is a real problem. One thing I point out in the book, though, is that the House and the means of representation in the House, even if we got rid of gerrymandering tomorrow, would also be undemocratic in ways that we should consider problematic. So the districts we have in this country are very large to begin with. This was something that Madison wanted, partially because it would make democratic politics more and more difficult. If you have to win in an electorate of 100,000 people, it takes more resources and more power and more finances to do that in a district of like 5,000 or 10,000 people. Right? The larger a constituency is, the more difficult it is to access democratic power. But also, the way that we draw districts, even if it's fair, would tend to advantage voters who live in less urban populations. People who live in cities are clustered in one particular area. People who live elsewhere usually get their districts drawn in such a way that empowers them more than people who are living in a tightly packed, dense region. And so people proposed a lot of different solutions to this. One of the things that I find particularly compelling is the idea of moving to proportional representation. the reform the people have talked about the most, you could have multi-member districts. So instead of sending one guy to office on the basis of plurality, so right now, if you win 40-something percent of the vote, somebody else wins 30-something percent. In fact, most people go to the polls, vote for another candidate who's not you. You can still win just because you got more votes than the next guy. That's fundamentally a number in itself. But the other thing it does is it creates a situation where you do have these incentives to gerrymander. You know, you're only going to get one person out of this district, so you better draw the lines in such a way that ensures that nobody else has a real chance. But also, I think there's something about allowing everybody a chance, a real chance at sending people to Washington that feels more intuitively democratic, then it opens up our politics a little bit. Instead, if you have a system where you elected, you know, 4, 5, 6, however many people it is per district, the majority gets a number of seats proportional to the amount of the vote that they got. But the other people, you know, Democrats or Republicans or third party, whoever happens to be, they also get to select their seats in aligned with their proportion of the vote. And so you send a pool of people to Washington, people who are ordinarily have their votes not really count for anything because they're not one of the top two winners or the top winner. They ultimately get some representation as well that opens the door to having third or fourth parties matter. So I think these are things worth considering. I think that we end up in a very narrow gerrymandering conversation because the system as it stands benefits both parties. They don't want to open the electoral system up to third party opponents, other party opponents. And so we have this narrow fight about gerrymandering every 10 years without thinking more broadly about how we could restructure the House in general. I think that there's no better time to start pushing that conversation.
The Senate, is it at all compatible with democracy?
No, it's not. And as much as the founders themselves distrusted, disliked democracy, even some of them thought that the structure of the Senate strayed too far away from democratic principles. Madison says this at the convention. Hamilton says it at the convention. It doesn't make sense. The only reason why we have equal representation is because the small states at the convention who had enjoyed equal representation under the Articles of Confederation forced the issue. As a matter of fact, there's a delegate from Delaware named Gunning Bedford who stands up during the convention and says, look, we can talk about this all you want, but ultimately, if we don't get equal representation in the Senate, we will consider joining up with some foreign power and leaving the United States. So they're forced into a compromise that many of the founders themselves recognized was not actually sensible as a matter of principle. You gave the numbers yourself earlier on, 67 times representation if you live in Wyoming that you would have then if you lived in California. People come to democracy, should come to democracy from a position of equality. That's one of the fundamental principles I talk about. If people are not equal within the process, you leave open the door to some minority of an electorate of a public actually being the ones with the governing power rather than the public as a collective. The public as a collective only has any chance of ruling collectively if each and every one of them has an equal say, equal standing within the process, and the Senate flouts that entirely. Unfortunately, there aren't very many easy fixes for this. I talk about, and I think we should, adding new states. If the territories want to join in, it should be given a referendum, decide whether they want to become independent or join the union as states. The District of Columbia, I think, expressed its preference for statehood for quite some time. I think it should be admitted as a state.
Now it's under federal occupation.
Now under federal occupation, which I think deepens the argument. Even to the extent that this kind of shifts the current partisan ideological balance in a more even direction, that doesn't fundamentally resolve the problem of every state, however small it happens to be, being granted two equal votes. Article 5 of the Constitution says that this is one of the few things, functionally, that you can't really amend. You can only change that arrangement if you get the unanimous consent of all the states. And so it's very hard to see what actually the solution is here beyond someday moving to a different compact that eliminates the Senate entirely or replaces it with something else. I think there's still a lot of nascent conversation about things in the interim we could do, but that's one of the, I think, the hardest problems to resolve. And one of the reasons why I am inclined to and say in the book that not tomorrow, not within the next 5 or 10 years, but some point in the coming decades, we should really have a new constitutional moment where we're coming up with a fundamentally document that works in a fundamentally different way.
Yeah, you are skeptical about having a constitutional convention now because the right seems very prepared for one and are very eager to have that because they would do many horrible things and make it a worse document than it already is. So what needs to be done to have a proper preparation for a constitutional convention?
Well, I think that there are a lot of things you can do in the interim, again, to democratize the system. I lay out some near to medium term reforms for all branches of the federal government that could be passed. Many of them could be passed with a Democratic Congress that was willing. You have things like the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact, which would be an end run around the Electoral College without an amendment. It's just a matter of getting the right number of states on board. So there are things like that that I talk about. I argue for them not just because I think they help us democratize the system, but I think that the push for these things helps us build an argument for democracy, a more democratic country, that hopefully over time emerges into a public consensus around replacing the Constitution eventually. We're not there yet, though. I think that, as you rightly point out, most of the energy about a convention has been on the right. They've invested a lot into the prospect of doing one in the next couple of years, where they'd, you know, put forward a balanced budget amendment to strangle the federal government. Maybe they'd make taxes illegal or something. So they've put in the work. They have all the money on their side. The public's not really paying attention. That's not the environment in which you would want to do change on the scale that I'm talking about. You really do want to have a kind of broad public consensus built by a movement for democratic reform. And those kinds of movements take time. One of the other reasons why I say this takes time is that building power for workers has to be part of the equation too. We have the constitution we have because some of the wealthiest people in the country came into a room in Philadelphia in 1787, closed the doors, brought a document out, and there was no real capacity for ordinary people to sort of force themselves upon the process. There were ratification debates and such, but the public was not organized. Working people were not organized in such a way that they were able to wrangle the document in a more democratic direction. I don't think we should have that happen again. Ideally, whenever this happens, you know, by the end of the century or whatever it happens to be, I'd like people, and hopefully ordinary people in the room too, but I'd like people who enter a room to work on a new constitution to know that if they come out of that room without a sufficiently democratic document, without a document that respects our democratic rights, there might be a general strike. There might be some kind of resistance among organized working people in this country. And I don't think you get to that world with 6% union density in the private sector as we have now. I think that you need more labor organization to really do something here. But that's going to take time. And it's one of the main reasons why I think that economic reforms are the kind I talk about at the end of the book are so important.
And we've only touched on a few of your ideas. I should tell the listeners that there's a lot more in the book. But in conclusion here, some of these ideas seem almost revolutionary in the current political environment. So offer some words of encouragement amidst what feels too much like despair.
I think that having a vision is important. I think it's what helps you get up in the morning. And we're at a moment now in American politics where it seems like people are bereft of vision. Obviously, that's true in the center. It's usually true in the center. But even on the left, I think there's been a lot of despair, especially since November. You have things like Mamdani in New York. They're encouraging people. But I think there's still this kind of miasma of uncertainty about where we're supposed to go, what the message is, how do we actually bring more people over to our side. And I think that the Democratic vision I'm talking about gives us some resources for building out a constituency for our politics in the American public. If you say to people who are very, very angry within the Democratic Party, ordinary voters, about Donald Trump and about authoritarianism, if you're angry about authoritarianism, here is a bunch of things about the economy and a bunch of things that structure our working lives that are also authoritarian. And for that reason, you ought to support the left on labor issues and giving workers more power. That, I think, ropes in a lot of liberals who not right now predisposed to thinking about the economy in that particular way. I think this is also a vision of democracy that does far more than the Harris campaign did to appeal to people who have an anti-institutional bent, people who went for Donald Trump, partially because they thought he'd take down the existing political structure.
I think people find appeals to democracy, which you heard people like Biden and Harris say, seem abstract. It's not
exactly something
that really moves them.
Exactly. And I think what you say to those people is, look, when we say democracy, we're not committing you to a defense of or protecting Washington. Washington doesn't work. And Washington doesn't work in ways that materially hurt you. What should be for instead is a vision of democracy that means you're going to have more power, more pay, more ability to resist your boss. That is democracy too. If we have a more democratic political system, and if we expand labor unions, worker power, and all the ways I talk about in the book, we will be doing more to fulfill the promise of democracy than Kamala Harris and Joe Biden and the establishment. If it's just an abstraction and it's something that, you know, your civics teacher told you was important in sixth grade or something, you don't understand how it's going to get you an easier time paying your rent. It's going to make it easier for you to pay for your groceries. I think you lose out to authoritarians. Your conception of democracy has to be one that is about empowering people in their material everyday lives, which I think democracy can do. I don't think it's just a matter of rhetoric. I do think that expanding unions, co-determination, works councils, sectoral bargaining, inclusive ownership, all of these things would build power for ordinary workers in this country that gives them more money at the end of the day and also puts them on the path to more prosperity than they have at present. That's not a way that anybody, I think, is used to hearing about democracy, even from the left. I think it's part of the left's ethos, but oddly enough, we don't really talk about it, I think, as much as we should. I say all this because I've been in the cause of political theory, and I think there's something that's inherently kind of optimism-giving about doing that. But to the extent that people are despairing and people are scared and uncertain because they don't know how we work out way out of the situation politically, I think that there are real concrete political answers here to our current situation that can help us build power and turn the page. And I guess we'll just have to see.
That was Osita Wanevu, author of The Right of the People, Democracy and the Case for a New American Founding, just out from Random House. His website is ositawanevu.com. That's OSITANWANEVU.com. Speaking of vision, I don't often find myself quoting scripture, but this phrase from Proverbs often comes to mind. Where there is no vision, the people perish. One feels that every day. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News, back after a musical break. Some of Domenico Scarlatti's Keyboard Sonata No. 547 in the Kirkpatrick catalog, performed by Scott Ross. Next, the political economy of menswear, specifically the evolution of the wardrobe of upper-class American men over the decades. No one talks about this topic with more authority and charm than Derek Guy, who has brought his initial Twitter celebrity into other platforms as well. Just Thursday morning, he had a sharp review of the lack of a breast pocket on Stephen Miller's jacket. This is why I tell people to try ready-to-wear first. Custom is risky because you could be out here railing against white hippies and communists, but your tailor has you looking crazy without a breast pocket. Of course, that's only one item in a long list of Stephen Miller's sins, but it's a refreshing perspective. Derek Guy. Real men just wear rough garb and covers up the parts that could get you arrested if they were exposed, but you know, any concern about dress otherwise for men is somewhat suspicious. What do you say about that?
Well, I think that's partly true and partly not true. I think it's partly true in the sense that fashion has long been considered a frivolous subject in Western culture. So Karl Marx, for example, used the word fashions in a derogatory sense, talking about how capitalism runs through the fashions of the day. I think it was something like that. And the parable of the emperor who has no clothes is about a man who seeks flattery over something trivial. And since fashion has long been considered pretty frivolous in Western cultures, it has been mainly the purview of women because they're excluded from quote-unquote serious sectors like government, academia, and so on and so forth. So to demonstrate that you were a person of the mind and you had a higher moral character, often that meant rejecting fashion. So many people who were kind of already pushed out of certain circles of respectability felt freer to adopt fashion. So if you were gay or if you were a woman, you were already kind of somewhat excluded from certain circles. You know, you felt a little bit more comfortable paying interest. I think it's actually often when you look around the world and you look across all of society, it's actually usually straight men, specifically often in the US, that are kind of peculiar in that they pay less attention than many other people. But I think it's also not completely correct in that I actually think men do pay attention to clothes to some degree. I've always said that if you give your average guy a choice between a free pair of pink jeans and a pair of blue jeans that he had to pay $50 for, most men would pick the blue jeans because they think that wearing pink jeans telegraphs something about themselves. So I think men do care about dress to some degree in that they're aware of what their clothes telegraph. And that's why many of them dress certain ways to telegraph that they are straight, quote-unquote, normal men or whatever it is.
You wrote in a Bloomberg piece a couple of months ago, the 1980s power suit was a sharp departure from the soft-shouldered Brooks Brothers tailoring of old money wasps and the disheveled denim of countercultural hippies. First, let's talk some about that old money wasp look. Talk a little bit about Brooks Brothers, its emergence, what it symbolized, and what the wasps were doing with that mode of dress.
Well, Brooks Brothers was originally a men's store that opened in New York in the 1800s, and they played an important role in the history of American clothing. They were the first to come out with a ready-made suit. So before Brooks Brothers debuted the ready-made suit, I think it was in 1849, I believe. Before then, men who wore suits would either get things made. Sometimes they'd have things made in the home, but many went to a tailor, which was someone who would make you a custom suit from scratch. But the invention of the ready-made suit is important because it set into motion the general production of ready-made clothing. The other important part of the reason why Brooks Brothers plays such an important role is that in the early 1900s, they debuted a garment called the number one sack suit, a soft-shouldered suit without a dart in the front. And a dart is a way to shape a garment to transform 2D cloth into 3D form by stitching down a fold, let's say. Without the dart, the garment doesn't hug your body as much. You end up getting a straighter side. There are other kind of distinguishing marks of the Brooks Brothers sack suit, but the soft shoulder, hook vent, and dartless front were the main markers. That suit, since Brooks Brothers was located in New York and over time expanded to some other big cities on the East Coast, became the place where upper class elite people shopped, usually at the time, white Anglo-Saxon Protestants. Many of these people would buy their clothes from Brooks Brothers and work in law, finance, and so on and so forth. So the clothes ended up taking on status. Over time, through the early 20th century, many of the things that landed on Brooks Brothers shelves, not only the sack suit, but also things like Shetland sweaters, polo coats, penny loafers, tassel loafers, all of those things ended up creating what was essentially kind of like a wasp identity. There were other satellite clothiers that, let's say, copied the kind of like what was eventually known as the Ivy League look. So, for example, J. Press and the Andover Shop were shops that were close to Yale and Harvard, but they primarily sold to students. And so those students could then get Brooks Brothers looking clothes without going all the way to New York. But this look essentially created the wasp look that we understand today. So I think of dress as social language. If you think of dress in terms of social language, then Brooks Brothers gave us our ABCs in terms of American style. And many people have used those ABCs to, you know, spell different words or different sentences and even create slang. So that's gone on from Ralph Lauren, who has essentially perpetuated the kind of like waspy look, to quote unquote streetwear brands like Amelie and Dior, who has taken some of those ideas like tennis sweaters, Shetland sweaters, and create more of a streetwear style. But the look essentially was codified in the early 20th century because of wasps.
And now, as the wasps faded as a social phenomenon in the 1970s, the power look of the 1980s stepped in. What did that signify to you? That describe what that power look looked like, but then what did that signify as social language?
And when we think of power tailoring, we think of strong padded shoulders. I mean, this was basically like Armani. Anyone who can remember that time, they think of strong padded shoulders, a lot of extension, nipped waist, a much longer jacket, lower buttoning point, really big pants. It'd be worn with Gucci horsebit loafers, worn with what was called a banker collar. So way back in the day, men often wore shirts and the collar would wear out and then they would have another collar stitched on for frugality, essentially. But the banker collar look was essentially a shirt that came with a contrast colored collar. Since it was worn by bankers, it was suggested that you were in kind of high finance. And this would be worn with what were called power ties. So it would be a bright satin tie in a very loud color, like a shade of red in the same color of like a children's birthday balloon or yellow.
The yellow tie was a big thing, wasn't it?
Yeah, yellow ties were a very big thing. In the contemporary sense, even though it's not an exact replica of that look, but Donald Trump wears that look still to this day. If you look back at early photos of him in the 1970s, like many young men, he played with the fashions of his day. He wore really giant lapels and these like very 1970s looks. But in the 1980s, as his fame started to rise, he really crystallized his look. And his look has not changed really since the 1980s. And it was that power suit, power broker, Wall Street finance look. The look is to say that I am a very successful, wealthy person. And this was distinctive from the WASP look, which essentially, to some degree, tried to play down power and wealth. But since it was worn by wealthy, you know, high status, powerful people, it became associated with wealth. The Brooks Brothers WASPy look, part of that is like wearing a jacket to the point where it's so threadbare that, you know, you might have patches on it. I think that's the departure, is that one look tried to play down the idea of wealth and value discretion, whereas the power broker look did not value discretion at all and really announced itself.
Finance was transformed from a very polite thing. You know, your end over roommate worked with you, but then it just became all about the deal, and you know, you're asserting yourself very loudly. So it was like shouting, both in style and in fashion. But then you had Ralph Lauren kind of imitating that old preppy style in the 80s. So what was he trying to do there?
That's one of the interesting things about Ralph Lauren, is that he's not a WASP, obviously, but he took that language and made it into something so beautiful. Someone recently asked me to sum up Ralph Lauren, and I think Ralph Lauren, even though Brooks Brothers, if you want to get into technical terms, is really the quintessential American brand, because again, they gave us our ABCs. In my mind, the true quintessential American brand is Ralph Lauren, because he took all of those ABCs and then invented this imaginary aristocratic class, and then also told the stories around all of those other kind of American groups, like the rancher, the Southwestern cowboy, the sportsman, all of these different characters. And he kind of created a Disneyland world where all of these characters would play a part. When I was growing up, anyway, I recognized Brooks Brothers as the place that you would shop if you were a rich white lawyer, essentially. But Ralph Lauren was where you shopped if you wanted to look cool. So in terms of sociological sense, yes, Ralph Lauren served a certain group of people, but Ralph Lauren gave it a certain kind of coolness that I don't think Brooks Brothers ever really had. Alan Fletcher said this in a book about Ralph Lauren that was released, I think maybe about 10 years ago. He noted that he thinks that the WASP look would have died without Ralph Lauren. The WASP look required that sense of coolness for it to continue, and Ralph Lauren gave it that sense of cool.
If I could step back to the Trump question for a moment. He always wears blue suits. Now, I know he's trying to do a flag motif, red, white, and blue, but what is the significance of the blue suit? The gray is much more classic. How does the blue fit in?
I don't know. That's a very good question. I don't know if he does it intentionally for the red, white, and blue, but I have also noticed that he does not wear any other color. I mean, no one really wears like olive and brown, and you know, very few men wear tan at this point. But you're right, he doesn't even wear gray, and I've noticed that. And I'm not quite sure. He is most obviously very aware of branding. When he was up for a comedy roast show, he told people that they could say anything about him, but they could not question his wealth. He's tied to the idea that he has to project the sense of wealth. And in the past, for example, when Sean Spicer, during his first day as a press secretary, Donald Trump reprimanded him for the way that his clothes looked. So he is very aware of how image affects his status and power. But why he chose blue, I would be surprised if even in the 1980s you could find a photo of him in a gray suit. And I don't know the reason for that. I don't think in the 80s he was thinking red, white, and blue, but I don't know the reason why he chose blue.
And the really, really long tie, what's he like, trying to do with that?
I think it was in his biography where Chris Christie offhandedly mentioned that Trump suggested to him that he wear a longer tie because he claimed it was slimming. I don't think that that's actually true. I don't think wearing a longer tie makes you look slimming, although somewhere in the back of my mind, I think what he's referring to is that there are those like historical figures where heavier men wore very high-waisted pants and a very short tie, and that was usually done sometimes on television for comedic effect. Maybe that made him think that a longer tie is slimming. I'm not really quite sure. But if the anecdote is true, and if Trump really did tell Chris Christie that, then perhaps he thinks wearing a longer tie makes him look slimmer. I do think that he does think about that to some degree, because his suit jackets have very extended shoulder pads, and that is essentially done to make the waist look slimmer.
I'm speaking with Derek Guy. Okay, back to the story of the evolution of elite men's dress. with the bursting of bubbles of the 80s and 90s, a more casual look came in. I recall a 2006 Wall Street Journal story about hedge fund chic, Armani shirt, Cole Haan shoes. It looked laid back, but the price tag would translate into about $2,500 today. You have any thoughts on that hedge fund chic look? Where did that come from? What were they trying to say?
What period are you referring to?
This was the Wall Street Journal story is 2006.
Many people, when they talk about the death of the suit, they peg it to a post-war story. I think it goes further back. To understand the death of the suit, you have to understand the entire genesis of liberalism. There are many, many, many different summations of liberalism. But what I'm referring to is the idea that shaped the Enlightenment period, which Isaiah Berlin summed up, that people are not, if they're not inherently good, they're at least not inherently bad. And that when they are not fooled by knaves and scoundrels, that they are the best steward of their own interest. And it's essentially the idea that people have inherent worth and dignity. And so this is the basic idea that allowed us to overthrow kings and create democracy, gave birth to the idea of free markets and more rational societies. And that idea is, as it developed capitalism and democracy, those forces are also what gave rise to the suit. The suit dethroned the frock coat, which was originally a long-fitted garment, which is what a proper gentleman would have worn. And for a time, the suit was considered not respectable garment, but it was not considered the most gentlemanly way of dressing. But as the people who wore suits saw their fortunes rise with industrial capitalism, that is the clerks and administrators that worked in these kind of like offices, as those people's fortunes rise, their clothes slowly started to take on status. And that is the kind of WASP class that we were discussing earlier. That force that brought in the suit is also eventually what killed the suit. In the post-war period, civil rights movement, anti-war protests, the Watergate scandal, waves of labor strikes, all of these things started to make people feel disillusioned about the suit, and people started to dress a little bit more casually. Nobody really wanted to look like Nixon, for example. You look at like young people in the 1970s dressing as hippies. The suit came back for a brief revival in the 1980s, as we were talking about. But in the 1990s, you had the business casual movement, where there was this idea that people could be more productive if they dressed more comfortably at work. But the important change of what you're discussing is that in the late 90s, early 2000s, the rise of the Silicon Valley class gave a certain kind of attire a new sort of meaning. So while Mark Zuckerberg didn't necessarily invent this uniform, and he was not the only person dressing casually at the time, certainly, I think he's the best poster child for this look. In my opinion, Zuckerberg and people like him made hoodies and jeans a new aspirational uniform. The hoodies and jeans uniform of Silicon Valley symbolized this idea of meritocracy, that you didn't care about formalities and you didn't care about clothes, that all you cared about was whether you could code and whether you could shape this new economy. And this idea of the hoodies and jeans stood opposed to the kind of suit and tie look of corporate finance and industry back east, which was the kind of old economy. And I think these ideas mixed in the general trajectory of liberalism, the business casual movement of the 1990s, and then the rise of the Silicon Valley class giving casual wear. It wasn't just that people could feel more comfortable at work, it's that you were a more noble person by dressing down, that you were actually of an elevated status. And I think those things then spread across all of industry and society, where more and more people want to dress down and the suit became less aspirational. We also still have these ideas of respectability. In these kind of Wall Street worlds, it's not that you can just show up in whatever. There's that famous, I think it was in Curb Your Enthusiasm, where somebody goes to get a will drafted, and they go to the lawyer, and the lawyer's in there with jeans and a denim Western shirt, and he's not going to use the lawyer because he's dressed too casually, because it doesn't project competence. So you still have to hold on to these general ideas of respectability and professionalism. So what you end up with is this really weird dress code where it's essentially not jeans, certainly not shorts. It could be tailored trousers if you want. It's often chinos. You have a button-up shirt. It has to be a certain kind of button-up shirt. It can't be a denim Western button-up shirt. It has to be something that would have historically been worn with a tailored jacket. But you lose the tailored jacket and you certainly lose the tie. And some people will replace it with like a finance vest or whatever. And I think over time, these are the sort of ideas that have developed this kind of new kind of uniform for the kind of that kind of corporate class.
In that Bloomberg piece, you also wrote about the metrosexual moment. What was that all about?
Well, the metrosexual, I think, was one of the first big breaks on this male performance. Tom Wolfe wrote an essay in the 1970s called The Secret Vice, where he claimed that men would rather be seen in public with a pornography magazine than a clothing catalog. I think he was exaggerating a bit, but it's actually not too far off. I think there is something about, as we were discussing earlier, hiding the idea that you're interested in clothes if you're a straight man in America, because people might cast suspicion on your gender or your sexuality. In the early 2000s or so, there was a certain kind of male consumer who was distinct not only in terms of their taste and interest in dress. These people knew the difference between, they wore slimmer clothes, they knew different shoe styles. They also bought like scented grooming products. It was a very groomed, curated man, but it was also a man who no longer cared if you cast suspicion on their gender or their sexuality. They were totally fine with coming out as a man interested in appearance. The term metrosexual was actually originally coined by a gay writer, but was soon picked up by the press to define this male consumer who took a very obvious interest in clothes, and everyone questioned, essentially, to some degree, their gender and sexuality, but that person somewhat didn't really care about it. And this was originally a city movement, really, San Francisco, New York City, but eventually became a mainstream look. I mean, many people today dress what would be called a metrosexual in the early 2000s, but it's now like youth pastors dress like this nowadays.
Okay, and then masculinity today. There are a couple of things to talk about here. One, that MMA look. Joe Rogan is the archetype. I mean, they're just trying to look tough and athletic and hard.
Yeah, I wrote something for Bloomberg about the rise of the alpha male, which is really an online character. Joe Rogan, I think, just dresses like a lot of guys. I don't think he has any particularly distinctive fashion, but the alpha male influencer spans many, many different types of people. There is a small subsect in there that will wear these really, really tight suits, these really tight jeans. And I think the idea is to show off that they're very muscular and very built, and therefore you should click their link in the bio, buy the supplement, buy the coaching program. They're advertising their body, essentially. I don't know if that's like a widespread fashion movement, but I think it is a kind of increasingly popular or increasingly influential online performer.
And then there's a MAGA look, which you sometimes make fun of, slim fit, exemplified by Matt Walsh and Vivek Ramaswamy. How would you characterize what they're doing?
I think the most notable thing about the MAGA look is, you know, when I grew up, there was a certain kind of Republican aesthetic. It was like Alex P. Keaton. It was very Brooks Brothers. Soft shoulder, tweed jacket, button down collar, rep straight tie. It was like William Buckley, if you look at photos of William Buckley. I think it's notable that when Ronald Reagan and Bush won their first election, at the events surrounding their inauguration, the GOP handed out free boxes. And inside those boxes contained commemorative blazer buttons made by Ben Silver, which you can still find on eBay today. If you go to eBay, look up Ben Silver Reagan button, you'll find all of these commemorative buttons. I think they actually look quite good. They handed these out because it was presumed that the people attending these events would have a navy sport coat. And of course, when you attach these gold-colored metal buttons onto a navy sport coat, you turn it into a blazer. You couldn't possibly imagine anyone doing that today, partly because very few people wear tailored clothing anymore. But also, the Republican MAGA aesthetic has changed. There is always a part of the Republican Party aesthetic is that kind of very traditional 1950s waspy Brooks Brothers look, because it's often looking back at that period of Americans saying that, you know, we should go back to this kind of society. But there's also a portion of the Republican Party look that is much more populist. So instead of handing out blazer buttons, of course, they would hand out red MAGA hats. They might hand out the t-shirt with the Never Surrender t-shirt, which is a t-shirt with Trump's mugshot on it. You look at the things that Trump has come out with, his branded items that have to do with apparel. They're the gold-colored sneakers. And so that aesthetic is less, we'll say, highbrow than the 1950s Brooks Brothers look. and certainly the look that symbolized the kind of Reagan Republican, and it's much more populist. And I think that demonstrates a shift in Republican politics where there is certainly still that kind of country club look, but a lot of Republican politics now, as far as aesthetics, is about that very populist look, which is certainly not something that George H.W. Bush would have ever worn, who was the last kind of WASPy Republican.
It does seem that the COVID experience made people less concerned with how they appear to others. It just seems like dressing for comfort is a thing, and like the idea that you are someone else's environment has receded. Am I misinterpreting that?
I think that's partly true. I think tailored clothing has been on a long decline since at least the post-war period. When you look at photos, candid photos of the 1950s and 60s, actually not everyone was wearing a suit. Many people were wearing workwear. And certainly, again, the 1970s rebellion, 1990s business casual, the rise of tech and Silicon Valley finance, all of those have kind of shifted us away from suits. But I think COVID dealt at least another blow. I remember when I was talking to tailors, there was a lot of concern over whether or not custom tailors would be able to survive if we completely moved to a kind of work from home environment. Right when things started to open up, I believe in 2021, tailors told me that they had a surge because essentially all of the pent up demand came in the around this, I think it was like the summer of 2021. All of a sudden people needed wedding suits and they're treating themselves to new clothes or whatever. But I do think that the lasting impact is that some people still may have a kind of one day at least work from home. And then there's just also a general kind of casualness. I think you can dress well casually, but I do think that there has been a shift towards more comfortable casual clothing and less interest in clothing.
That was Derek Guy, the menswear authority and social media personality. You could find his work on his website, Dye Workwear, dieworkwear.com. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go at this, some of Mr. Suit from Wire. Sorry for all the bleeps, but we've got the FCC looking over our shoulders. Till next week, bye. 1, 2, 3, 4!